quality pistols were not that easy to get, so it was war supplies. You know, if you were screwed up with a bag of quartz crystals from Brazil, they probably would throw you in jail.
Yeah, I know they were added of some crystals to be covered with it. I mean, the thing is, the crystals, the highest the frequency. That was the rule that I got when I was young. But we had the method of placing a layer on the crystal by itself. So that was done either with the small non-conducting not insulator. It was rather material that was able to store the energy. So I'm trying to recall that. Yeah, you know better.
Okay, there's a bunch of things that affects crystal, what its resonant frequency tends to dimensionality and the material qualities. If it's more ductile, the frequency gets lower. If it's more rigid, frequency goes higher. So think in terms of if there's any magic way that you can actually change the rigidity of the crystal matrix in a quartz crystal.
Okay, the basic rule is that the quartz crystal is proportional to its dimensions. So if you try to change the dimension, whichever way you try to do it, you're changing the frequency of the quartz. Am I right?
Also, pressurizing and or using a crystal oven to change the temperature comes to mind.
Oh, that is a good one. That's a good one. I never heard that metal enclosure of the quartz is pressurized or is vacuumized, if I could use that kind of word, Dr. Roy.
I agree, but I'm touching the source here.
No, I understand. And yes, if you heat, you know, we all pretty much have crystals in ovens that they heat up rather quickly to a specific temperature and don't have to deal the wandering around of a crystal's frequency as our gear heats up around it. But that's a kind of a temporary thing. That's a characteristic that is environmental. This is one that hopefully should stick for most of the war. So they did something to the crystals that affect, in addition to the dimensions, as I said before, the rigidity of the crystal lattice plays a part. If it's more rigid, it would increase the resonant frequency. If you made it a little floppy, it would make it a little bit lower frequency. So in terms of what might change the ductile nature of a quartz crystal. Okay, so I will take it from that everyone gives up. They exposed it to X-rays. Apparently, under some circumstances, they blasted it with X-rays. And then they would test it again, and if it needed a little bit more tweaking, they'd blast it again and again and again. So that's what they did in World War II to save crystals that were a little bit too high in frequency. Exposure to X-rays, they would disrupt the crystalline matrix and allow it to be a little bit less rigid.
Yeah, but the question is, how the X-ray changes the properties of crystalline? Back to you.
It gets into the atoms and it heats the bonds up themselves. And so it disrupts the crystalline structure. Not enough to disrupt the whole piezoelectric effect, but enough defects to reduce slightly the crystal rigidity.
Well, but from the perspective of reaction that or interaction of X-rays with the crystal, is it changing it chemically? Is it changing it mechanically? And if yes, then how? Back to you.
it's changing it structurally. It's disrupting occasional bonds in the crystal lattice. The crystal is basically a bond that are bound to each other in a uniform way with a few missed atoms, because nothing is perfectly perfect. So you have to kind of adjust things for each crystal that you use. And some of those bonds can be disrupted enough by energizing, you know, X-ray photons onto the bonds, where you disrupt enough bonds to change the plasticity, the ductility, the rigidity, however you want to describe it, of the crystal lattice structure. So it's not like it's turning it into a different chemical. It's just breaking up all the bonds and weakening the crystal lattice structure.
You're talking about changing fundamental frequency, but also the overtone frequency as well, in corresponding way.
Yeah, you know, like anything, the harmonics get changed as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Something new. I didn't know about it.
Okay, that's a good thing. That means that the puzzle was a good puzzle, if people learn something new. Now, just in case, as you're all to say, you know, Roy, you're making the stuff up. It's all nonsense. Well, I if you go to Roy's link page, that's roy.ac2gs.com, I just put up a link. It's a YouTube. It goes back to 1943. And, you know, it has that dirty film effect, unfortunately, but it's very much of 1943, and it goes into the entire manufacturing in 1943 of radio crystals, from them unboxing the Brazilian crystals all the way to putting them in little packages so that they could be plugged into the rails. I hope some people take a look at the link and watch it and enjoy it. And I'm glad if a few people learn something new tonight.
Okay, a question for you. Do you know that frequency drift with temperature is present in crystals in regards to quartz, or do you think that it's not significant?
No, it's significant. You know, I mean, talk to some old-timer who doesn't have an oven temperature control crystal oscillator, especially when he just kind of turns it on. I talked to a gentleman just today on 10 meters. He started off a frequency, and then we got him adjusted straight on, and then as his radio warmed up even more, he was off frequency again. So, yeah, a non-temper controlled crystal can be a very annoying thing. Is it going to move you to another band? Possibly not, but it's going to take your frequency as it heats up.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. As always, Wesley, for participating. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. And I hope you like the TechNet puzzle. It's very difficult to find one. And I was able to find one that worked well with D-Day. You know, we don't usually talk about World War II that much on the TechNet. So thanks to everyone. And now it's time for Paul to end with the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS, WS2N, very good. I remember Pam's used to try to get the first crystal out of all the TVs because they were close to 80 meters. I remember the TV out looking for it, just to cut it out, just to say that I had one. But I forget what it was, 3.6 something or other. And it was very close to the frequency that we would use. Do you remember, right?
WPDAV knows all about it. You got 30 seconds?
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember the frequency. That was 3.5 or other.
3.5795, which was right on top of the then, not anymore, 80-meter W1AW hook distribution. And I actually published the design of something that took a little Radio Shack amplifier and added a little mixer using one of those crystals to make W1AW receiver.
Very good. Thanks for the history on that. I was trying to remember the frequency. as you guys are talking about the crystals. Thank you, Ed.
My pleasure. That was a lot of fun for me. Unfortunately, WNW Code Practice has moved the frequency, and that is now meaningless.
Yeah, okay, very good. I remember. So, sorry, if people throwing out TVs, you know, you ride out of the street, a ham would take it looking for the crystal. But, you know, had to be a color TV, though. Wow. Okay. I know we went over it earlier, but Bill Andy's died in a private plane. And, yeah, I got the information from BBC, so they said it was a Beechcraft, and also known as a T-34. Ed, if you're thinking of the T-38, that's different. They're the jet planes that, you know, there's a front seat and a back seat that NAS uses for training. You're probably thinking of that. Is that true, Ed?
There has been an entire series of training planes that begin with the T. World War II started with the T-Texan. It ended with the T-28. And started with the jets.
Yeah, the prop, you know, it's the Beechcraft T-34. But I know the, like when the astronauts flew into Houston, they still do that. They'll from, let's say, Florida, but, you know, or the other way around. When they live in Houston, they want to fly to get ready for a flight, and they fly over to Florida, they take the I'm sure it's T-38. I can look it up real quick. I'm pretty sure it's the number. But quite EVC went down in a prop plane. But we'll see as time goes on. We'll see it.
I have the radio downstairs and the computer upstairs. I'll be back in a few. WB3.
And, yeah, Jeff, go ahead.
Just an odd little anecdote. I don't know anything about these planes to speak of, but I happen to live in a strange little place where at least once a week, if not many more times, the T-6 Texan trainer flies right over at my house at the Bayport Aerodrome. And it's a magnificent plane that comes over. It's a piece of history that is amazing. I get to experience it regularly. Odd little dose, but I figured I'd add it in. I don't know what the heck it does. It just sounds magnificent.
Yeah, that's pretty cool to see now. And see a lot of strange planes coming in and out of Islip Airport. I'm in Ronkonkoma, so I'm not too far from the airport. Sometimes I see some strange things, you know, going overhead. But look for that one. Maybe I'll get to see that. You go in the backyard, you know, you're hanging out in a lawn chair, you know, you look it up, here comes these planes flying over. It's pretty good. All right, let me just move on. Okay, to the Starliner story. This thing has been in the making for, well, I guess 11 years. And finally, successfully got off the ground on the 5th, on Wednesday. They thought it would be originally up in the air by maybe 2019 or 2020. But, you know, constant delays. They find things, rebuild things, change things. You know, the list went on and on over the last couple of years. There was competition between Boeing and SpaceX. Who was going to send a crew to the International Space Station first, a commercial crew. So, and there was some kind of a flag that they had put by the door hatch, and the idea was whoever gets there first gets to claim that flag. That flag was put up there by the last crew that had left on a shuttle. So sure enough, SpaceX won a couple of years ago. They were flying crews up to the space station every 6 months, and they did a couple of commercial crew flights on, you know, with Axiom. They did two of them, and Boeing, you know, was left in the dust. You know, the hair and all that. Sure enough, I finally got off the ground after trying to launch it at the beginning of May. And oxygen relief valve. Went to look at that. Bring it back to the facility. Take a lot of things apart to get to it. And they realized there's a helium leak they had to deal with. Turns out that's not fixable, and without really doing a major job, major overhaul. But they determined that the helium leak they had, even if 100 times worse than it was, it wouldn't matter. And it's in our gas, but they weren't worried about it. And they use it for pushing our propellant through the lines, and also opening and closing our reaction control jets. They have around 64 different thrusters on board Starliner. I think out of 12 on the Starliner, but the rest of them are on the service module. The problems with that, actually, a year and a half ago when they set up an uncrewed Starliner that docked with the space station successfully, they had some problems with those thrusters as well. And they disposed them this time, but they still had problems. Like I said it earlier, with five of them, they got four to restart. And from what I heard during the news conference, they have a software fix that they could do. They have the different settings one way or another. I guess it creates a limit switch, and when the limit sees it, it automatically shuts down that thruster. So they found a way around it, no problem. They were getting close to the space station after launch. Like I said, it went up on us with Sonny Williams. By the way, she's a ham, KD5, PLD, and Bud Wilmore, he was the commander. He's not a ham, but they got within, around two distances of a football field, right? About 600 feet or so.
WB-280.
Yes, Ed, go ahead.
The T-34 initially came out in 1955 with a radial piston engine. But after about 20 years, they changed them over to turboprops of about 550 horsepower, which is really hot for putt-putt. But it is basically a single-engine propeller plane, but 550 horsepower is pretty hot.
Okay, well, for now, I'm going to think that's what he was flying. I just don't think he would have been flying it sounded like he was one article was heading home. So I don't think I had a jet stored in his driveway. But I don't know how many times he was flown back and forth. I don't know the history of this of his flights. But something went wrong. And like I said earlier, I don't know if it was medical or mechanical. But time will tell. But anyway, we lost a good astronaut, one of the three. Foreman and Lowell and Anders. But the argument for Deck was who took that trip. And in the long run, Lowell finally came out and said it wasn't me, it was Anders. So he's going to get credited with the photo. So, okay, so the Starliner, it got through this one, a standoff area that they would say you don't come within this certain beyond 600 feet. So everything checks out. In other words, if things did not check out on Starliner, they would have just commanded it to go back home and not dock at the International Space Station. Although they pretty much knew that they would be able to override that system too, because there's redundancies. They have triple redundancies with all these thrusters. So they realized they got four out of five working, and they allowed them to dock with the Harmony module. space station has four docking locations for the American side, or American European side, and then there's four on the Russian side. There's two berthing stations. That means that's where the robotic arm would grab a vehicle and attach it directly to the module with 16 bolts that would, you know, tighten up and seal it that way. It's much bigger diameter. You can bring in bigger things to and from the station. The docking module is small. It's roughly 1 meter in diameter. Instead of like 54 inches wide. So it's designed for, you know, rapidly being able to leave. Let's say there was a disaster on the space station, you know, fire or ammonia leak or whatever, and they had to leave the ISS. They would get into their respective vehicles and pull away. And they could do that all, you know, was inside the spacecraft without the help of somebody inside the ISS. Where the berthing system, you kind of need somebody to operate the robotic arm. And if there was an emergency, you know, who would stay behind? So that there's two different designs, the berthing system and the docking system. Anyway, that's where the vehicle is right now. It's sitting in the front facing port of the ISS, which is you have a whole string of modules. One in the front is the Harmony module, and if you drop back going, you know, behind that, you have the Discovery, Destiny lab module, and then followed by another node, or they call it the Unity module. And it just keeps going back behind that, start attaching to the Russian segments. They have two in line. And the Russian side is like the tail end. The Harmony end is like the front end. See, a bit like that. Like the space station, you know, has front and back. Starliner is now in the very front of the SS, attached to the pressure mating adapter. That's sticking out of it. There's three pressure mating adapters on the International Space Station. That's what they dock to. There's an international docking adapter called IDER that the spacecraft dock to. It's a universal type of setup where no matter what vehicle from whatever country in the future docks to the space station, they'll be able to do that. With that, the crew went inside. I saw a 15-minute, I guess you call it YouTube from there, with Sonny Williams and Butch Wolf and all, more giving a tour of inside the Starliner. That was pretty cool. And they showed the seating arrangements. They showed, what things like. It was dark at the time that you couldn't see out the window when they gave the tour. About a 15-minute tour. They enter, and they showed them float into it. And at the end, they showed them float out. And within a week or two, the Starliner from the space station with the same two people can fly back to New Mexico. Thing is designed to land on land. It can land in water if it has to. But it's designed to land on land. In this case, White Sands, New Mexico. Southern New Mexico, I know. John is out there. He's still listening. You get on to 25, interstate. If I was up in Denver, and I went all the way to about 25. Pretty much as far as I can go before you run out of room and wind up in Mexico. You come to White Sands. Big area, and that's where they're going to come down and land. So they come through the atmosphere with a heat shield, and you have open up, and that will slow down even more. And then as it comes closer to the ground, I think about a mile off the ground, the heat shield will separate from the vehicle, and that will close like half a dozen airbags. really what they are. And right at the last few seconds, those will open up, inflate, and soften the land. So they're going to be real curious on what Sonny and Butch think when they land in a week or two. Anyway, it's WS.
Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform.
Good evening, Charlie. How are you? What's your comment?
This Starliner, this is not to come back and land like airplane?
No, it's a capsule design, you know, similar to what we saw years ago with the Saturn V went up, Apollos came down, and the Apollos were capsule designs. In that case, they would come down a parachute, land in the water. But what we saw just recently, a little over a year ago, when the manned spacecraft came back, unmanned from a trip around the moon. And again, that came through with parachutes and landed in the water, also capsule design. So no, not like the shuttle. There is something being built that's going to be going up probably in a couple of months called the Dream Chaser. And that will launch on a rocket, dock with the space station, unmanned. That will be delivering supplies. And then when that comes through the atmosphere, that's the one that you're thinking of that will land like a plane. That's called Dream Chaser. Charlie, back to you.
They're going to have to slow this landing craft down really, really slow to make a soft landing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, they're at 17,005 miles an hour in orbit right now. And then they separate from the ISS. They come through the atmosphere, suck up gas around 250,000 feet up. They really start to hit the atmosphere, creates a plasma. The heat shield in the front end. Well, they actually have heat protection all the way around, but the main heat shield is it comes in the first. And that'll heat up to, I think they said, that thing goes up to around 3,000 or so degrees. Orion, when that comes back, will be up there almost 5,000. So, it's coming back faster from the moon. So, okay, so then now the heat shield protects the crew line. And then as it gets down lower to a more manageable speed, just, I think it's below sonic speed, the drogue chutes come out, drogue chutes pull out the main parachutes, and then, like I said, you get to within about a mile or so of the sun, they jettison the heat shield, and then now what's left on the bottom is these airbags that don't inflate until the last couple of seconds right before they land. So back to you, Charlie.
Those airbags are going to be enough to soften the blow from this the spacecraft coming down.
Yeah, you're coming down with three big parachutes, and they get close to the ground. I think they said 11 miles an hour, and then. Then the airbags open up, so I think they could survive up to 16 or 20 miles an hour if it was coming down, faster. It'd be quite a jolt, but they've already done this before twice with this particular craft. Starliner went up. This is the third time it went. First time without a crew. First time. It didn't make it to the ISS, but it did come back and land in White Sands, New Mexico. The second time it went up, it did dock with the International Space Station, but it went up without a crew, and they checked everything out. And again, when that came home, it landed safely in the White Sands, New Mexico. And the same thing with with this one, Charlie. That's what they're going to do. Back to you.
Right, as long as it's tested out.
Yeah, well, that's what NASA does. I mean, they really test and test and over test. You know, probably hundreds of drops have been done from, say, they send up cargo planes and they drop the simulated weight out of the planes. You know, what this thing weighs, I think it's 20,000 pounds or something. And then they test the parachutes that way over and over again, and they beat them up at this problem. But they did notice the last time when they came, they felt the connecting straps between the parachutes and, you know, and the vehicle itself. They wanted them to be a little stronger in case for some reason one of the parachutes didn't open up. They took, you know, the margin close. So, I mean, they rebuilt everything with the last year and a half and did the same thing. Brought it up to altitude, you know, like 6 miles high, and used the mass simulator, pushed it out of a cargo vehicle, a cargo plane, and they test the parachutes that way. Any comments?
No, as long as everybody's safe, you know, everybody knows what they're doing.
Oh yeah, for sure. You know, and they've got to do a real, you know, as soft as they can. They're landing on land. The water, you know, you got a little bit of a break when you hit the water. And when they hit water, if you ever notice, they come down. They don't come down blunt first when they hit the water. They have it where it's a little bit, you know, where it kind of cuts into the water when they hit. That's what I like about, you know, NASA. They really orbit. And SpaceX does thing with their vehicles, but that's, you know, I don't think they test as much as, nobody tests as much as NASA. NASA has all kinds of, they spend billions of dollars on simulators and this and that. You know, that's what I like about them. Before they put any vehicle up, a rocket or a spacecraft, they really go through extensive testing. I just wanted to move on to one other topic, is Starship, talking about SpaceX. Starship got off the ground, Starliner by Boeing went up on the 5th, docked a little over 24 hours later to the International Space Station one day later. That, on the 6th, the same day, in the morning, SpaceX launched the 4th version of their Starship, and you know, the idea was to send this almost 400 foot long vehicle, 7 feet in diameter, you know, up through the clouds with 33 Raptor wrench firing on the bottom, and that successfully lifted off, and they got to the staging. The idea is to separate the heavy booster from the Starship. That worked out very well. They get up a certain altitude in the airspace. I think it's around 50 kilometers. They start the Starship engine, which is on top. There's six of them. Yeah, three vacuum engines fire first. Everyone's on the outside, and it's still attached to the main booster. And they, in between, they have this interstage, and you can see right through. It's about, looks like it's about 8 feet long, and designed to be attached to two vehicles and have the Starship light its engine at the same time as, you know, without separating the main booster on the bottom to call it a hot fire system. It's been used before by Russia, and now doing it. So, you know, they designed it where that, you know, once that happens, the booster separates from the Starship. Starship keeps on going what would be normally orbit. The booster, you know, starts to come back and then disconnects the hot staging unit. It's 8 foot long, 27 foot diameter, 20,000 pound thing. They get rid of that, makes it a lot lighter. And then the booster was planned on coming back to the Gulf of Mexico. See, this thing takes off from Boca Chica, Texas. As it's coming down, it's going to land in the Gulf of Mexico. They want to learn land vertically. So it's first, you know, from space, it did a boost back. It relit 13 engines and thrust light, 13 engines. One of them failed. And it came back to, you know, closer to Florida. And then right before it landed, it lit its engines again, slowed down even more. And they had pictures of this thing, you know, live pictures on the inside the vehicle. So you saw it come down right near the water, and then touch water, and then it fell off. So that was successful. That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to duplicate a vertical landing. It's going to be a vertical takeoff, vertical landing system. So it worked out well. And the Starship kept going, you know, the upper part. Another, 100-ton thing flying in space. And that flew all the way, you know, over India to the Indian Ocean. And then once over the Indian Ocean, that thing started coming through the atmosphere. It was designed to do that, you know, suborbital plan. You know, that's what they said. They did not want to go into orbit with this thing yet. And sure enough, it came through the atmosphere, and they had pictures of that. It was coming through. It has these fins in the front that are moving, guiding it, you know, like a belly flop as it comes through the atmosphere. And sure enough, when that got near the Indian Ocean, near the bottom, that turned briefly and, you know, came back tail first, just like it was going to land, except it landed in the water. Was the plan. So they had a success. The first three of these starships that they launched, they had, you know, some success, but a lot of, you know, some of the degree they were blowing up. These two were separate vehicles that, you know, when they went up, they became separate vehicles. Were both successful. If they had a landing pad, theoretically, they would have been able to land on land with both vehicles. And we'll see what happens in the future. He's got plans, probably on number 5, which is this one, to actually bring the booster all the way back to Boca Chica, Texas, where it's off. He plans on catching it with these two gigantic arms. So, I mean, that's his prediction. We'll see. We'll see if he does that. That's ultimate goal, to have it be caught, refueled, and relit, and then relaunched. So this thing is supposed to be eventually 100% reusable. We'll see. I'm glad for it's got probably 11,000, 12,000 workers, and it's good, you know, for them. They do put a lot of work in trying to design this stuff. Any comments? WS1.
Just one. Now, Spex has 14 tentative Starlink launches just for the month of June. Month of June has 20 days left. These guys got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I know that. They've probably got like 40 or 50 launches in already with the Falcon 9. And they keep watching these, like I said, the Starlink satellites. They're doing around 22, 23 at a time now. That's their new version. It's bigger than the original ones they used to launch. They were much smaller. They were able to do like 50 at a time. and now they're doing 22 or 23 at a time. And one after the other. So I've got one out of Vandenberg Air Force Base, and sometimes they launch out of Florida. But that's a completely different deal than the Starliner. Not the Starliner, the Starship they built. We'll see. A lot of good things going on. New Glenn is under development. New Glenn is being built by Blue Ark, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon. And they expect to have a launch in a couple of months as well from the lift vehicle. Another one of these things, like, you know, as big as the Saturn V. So that'll be their end. Again, that will be reusable as well. It's a similar system to SpaceX. They're going to be landing their vehicle on a barge, like SpaceX does, with the Falcon 9. These people are going to do it with even a bigger spacecraft, a bigger rocket. The New Glenn. They have a couple of important launches that they want to do first. Very first launch that they do, whenever that goes up, I believe it's in September for NASA. They're going to be sending a couple of satellites to Mars. So that's really high confidence by NASA and by Blue Ark to take their first launch and put a couple of satellites for Mars. And I'm looking at the time. I'm going to start winding down here. We'll say 73 for now. We'll try to make it off to the Club Info Net, and that would be tomorrow. And that's always followed by Swap and Shop. And that's always followed by Newsline. Roy, over to you, AC2GS, WSN for the SpaceNet Report. By the way, this is SpaceNet Report number 600. And since I've been counting, this has been TechNet number 2000. And I'm sure it's a lot more than that, because we just had a rough number when we started counting years ago. Back to you, Roy, WS2S.
AC2GS, yeah, the TechNet's been going on for 44-plus years. We had an exact start date. Someone must have it someplace in their head. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do here on the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially do. I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. I hope you had a good time. I hope you learned a couple of things. And I hope you'll join us next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. You know, our rebels now are done. As Dick used to end his technical nets, be kind to each other, please. And wouldn't be one of my tech nets if I didn't end it with good old hepatitis. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. Try and keep your mind open. Try and learn something new every day if you can. You know, the old adage, if you don't use it, you lose it. So everyone, have a great week. Be what they say. Enjoy yourself. And please come back next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. This is A2GS, formally closing this episode of the Linemark Technical Net with the line, Slava Ukraine.
AE2HAU, good night all. I'll wait until next Sunday.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeat. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Linemark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Skymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Skymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Skymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet night at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Skymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Thank you. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Today. What a beautiful day.
Yeah, I was outside with the dog, so it seems like a nice day, and hopefully summer is on its way.
Well, that would be nice today. I am off today, so I am going to run a few errands, hopefully have some free time to play with the radio. Just going to shopping by food. How are you?
Yeah, we're fine. We're doing good. We had a nice weekend. Our first grandson's bar mitzvah was this weekend, so it turned out to be great weather and, you know, a nice thing for us. At our age, a nice thing for us to celebrate.
Yeah, certainly at any age, but that's great. I was going to ask you something, and I cannot remember what it was. What are your plans for today?
I have a guy, you know, when you have a contractor, hopefully he know things are going right, but, you know, that's always show up with this, but I decided to have my gutters replaced. They're up about, I think my gutters are up 30 years, maybe, something like that. And a couple of problems, and they're overhanging, but I wanted to put something like a roof guard on there, because there's a tree that overhangs, it clogs the drains, and me up. So I was going to put the leaf things on, and then I think, well, if I'm going to put them on, I might as well with the gutters to make sure I'm spotting them. So he's supposed to show up sometime this morning and do the gutters for me.
Well, hopefully he'll show on time. The project will go as planned. Do you remember the old, the Money Pit, where it was with Tom Hanks, and they were working on a house, and on their house, and every 10 minutes in the show, you know, how long it's going to take, and every answer was 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's like the shoemaker, the story of the guy who went to World War II, but he just dropped his shoes off at the shoemaker, and he came back 3 years later, and he says, yeah, my shoe's ready, and the guy says, yeah, I'll be ready tomorrow. This particular guy, he was good on the phone. One guy told me I needed a new roof, this guy knows, just you need to a little bit. Shook hands, he didn't ask for money up front, so I figured he's financially, you know, okay. So I'm hoping he's going to show up. I haven't had that experience with contractors this year.
You know, I guess I have a mixed history with contractors, some good, some bad. Even people sometimes that you have good word of mouth, you end up having issues, but hopefully it will go fine for you. I am almost at my first stop. I have to get gas, so I will be in and maybe talk to you later during the day. Alpha, Alpha, Golf Charlie.
Yeah, very good, Ted. Yeah, I had a problem with contractors, and different people hit it off differently in their expectations. I'm a pachetch when it comes to things, because there's a lot of things that I know, and I know something's not done, maybe not always if it's done 1,000% correct, but, you know, I know of things, and a lot of people just accept it, and they say, yeah, this guy was good, but in fact, he grew. So, hopefully this will work out well. We'll keep you informed. Have a good day, Ted. Maybe we'll catch you later. ATGC, KTKND.
K2KNB, KD2KNH.
Morning, Charlie. How are you doing?
Very good, thanks. Beautiful day, and can't complain. Haven't talked to you in a while. How's everything going?
Yeah, not really. Just been busy last month or so between doing the Ham Fest and Field Day stuff and, you know, grandson's bar mitzvah and things like that. So I've been on, but listening probably more than anything else. Everything's good. What about yourself?
Yeah, same here. Too busy. Anything's going on. Missed the Hamfest. Totally forgot about it, and I was busy there anyway. Busy with my other club, my other, those are all busy time of year now. And, having a lot of...
Yeah, Hamfest turned out well. You know, we just have some of the prime vendors, and I think that's going to be the future, but anyway, everything turned out well. By the way, is there anyone, or at least in your company, anyone making a 12 by 18, what do I want, a 12 by 18 black laser printer? Or, you know, laser, not color, black and white laser printer.
You know, I know some of our bigger machines do 12-teen, you know, black and white in color, but, you know, you're looking for a desktop printer?
Well, yeah, it's, you know, it's for someone who does screen printing. Right now he's using an HP, and I forget what the model number was, but it was like a standard of the, you know, the industry, 12 by 18, but once they got into the upgraded Windows, I guess maybe from Windows 7 on, you know, maybe it worked well with XP, but from Windows 7 on, you had to use a universal driver, and it does some weird stuff. You can't get it to go into, you can't get it to go into, I think, portrait mode, so you have to do it in landscaping and then turn it into printer. It's just complicated, so my friend was looking for something new in a 12 by 18, but he only needs a black laser so he can do the vellum for screen printing.
Well, you know, I don't work with a lot of that size format, so I don't know what's available in that size. We are an HP dealer, but if we just buy a printer, he might be better off looking on Amazon.
Yeah, again, I think the 12 by 18 is what they may have changed. There's, I don't remember if it's 11 by 17, I think, is tablet size. But when doing screen printing, at the very least, you want to be 12 by 12 or sometimes even larger. That 11 throws you off because the 11 is really going to be, let's say, 10 and 3 quarters. So, you know, I have been, I'll keep looking for him, but I just thought maybe you knew offhand.
You know, we did somebody recently, they had an old HP and had the upgrade. I don't know if HP had anything, but, maybe we went with a Kyocera, or that's a possible. I'll check with one of our sales guys when I drop by the office, and I'll let you know.
All right, sounds good. I have a Xerox that is a small format, so 11 by 14, 8.5 by 14 would be the biggest that I could do. And if I'm doing one piece, I might take two of them, you know, print, if the design is large, you just print it in two sheets. Just have to be careful. You know, it's funny, Charlie, because of the heat, particularly with vellum, if you split your image and you print it one after the other, you might have a difference in size, because the heat would have expanded the paper or your lines won't match up. It's pretty interesting. But, I'll take a look at it. If you could find out, again, it's just important in that particular industry.
Yeah, understandable. We used to print a lot of vellum at my father-in-law's place. They would make their own plates for pad printing and hot stamping.
Yeah, and it was kind of crazy, you know, until I realized exactly what was happening. I said, whoa, you know, now I've got to cut this paper down and take a line of, you know,